Welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. Today, we've got a man with a career that I couldn't even begin to sum up. Started off his life in MI6, went on to become a best-selling author, now a keynote speaker. We're joined by the great Matthew Dunn. Matthew, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me on your show.
I really, really appreciate you being here. I'm really excited to get into this. There's loads for us to go over and cover. We always start our podcast off the same way, and this might be a tricky one, given how many different things that you do. But if you were to introduce yourself and tell us the problem that you solve, how would you sum that up?
You partially introduced me already, but yeah, Matthew Dunn. I was a MI6 intelligence officer for many, many years, operating primarily solo around the world in various hotspots, targeting specifically the highest echelons of rogue states. After service, I became a best-selling author, and to date, I've written 14 published novels. So that's been an activity for around about the last 12, 13 years. Other stuff as well, primarily creative, focused, such as TV, theater, and various other things involving television and radio. So that's been my life to date. And in terms of how do I solve problems, I think just primarily a sense of never giving up, always one foot in front of the other, keep going no matter what. And obviously within the process, there is problem solving and trying to be creative, latitude of thought, all of that. But really, I have a real deep-rooted sense of resilience, perseverance, just keep going.
Do you think that resilience is something that you were taught, or is that something that you came out of the womb with, that resilient gene?
Oh, blimey, let's get all sort of psychological about this whole thing. I don't really know the answer to that, but I think, yes, certainly since childhood, I've always had this sense of looking over the horizon, wondering what's out there, imagining what's out there, having sort of, almost fantasies about, adventure and all of that kind of stuff. So possibly there's sort of a pull and push factor within my psyche, a desire to get away from, what was a nice childhood, but fairly humdrum, and get out into the world and live life. And so within that dynamic, there was sort of fire in my belly and certainly a sense of nothing's going to stop me. So possibly that was innate. That was from the womb, as you say. Over the years, certainly in adulthood, but before that as well, it's been refined. I've seen others do it and I've done it, and it's a sense of, yes, this can work. I always have a belief that we as human beings can tend to be a little bit navel-gazing if we're not careful. Always sort of thinking that other people are judging us and that we are the center of the universe and all of that side of stuff. And I think, well, it doesn't, it's not the case. And we can make mistakes along the way. We can trip up. We can, do stuff that in retrospect we would have done differently and all the rest of it. But, people don't care. Just keep going. Keep doing stuff. And, there is a very good chance as a result of that success can follow.
Matthew, I'm so curious with your career. You're going to have to take us back, I guess, those kind of early days. How do you end up working for the MI6?
It's all very bizarre. I mean, I'll take even a further step back in terms of my thinking, which was as a child, I was a voracious reader, and you may think, well, okay, what's that got to do with anything? But the books, pre-digital age, as it was back then, were my fuel. They were my portal to the world out there, as I've described it, the exotic, intriguing world that I craved and sought. And, as a young kid, like many young kids, I guess, you know, every week, every month, I always dreamed about being something. When I grow up, I want to be this or want to be that, and go through various different permutations. And at one stage, and I can't be exact about this, but let's say something like 13 or 14, I do remember, and it might sound very cheesy, but I remember reading Ian Fleming. I hadn't seen the movies, the Bond movies, but Ian Fleming's James Bond. And for some reason, I was really drawn to the notion of this very sort of charming, mysterious character moving around the world in circles where nobody knew his real name, and he was doing top secret, very dangerous work. And by the way, he was also carrying a Walther PPK sidearm. And I don't know why, but I found that very, very interesting. I had an interest in travel, and I thought, well, combine that with being a secret agent. I mean, that's the dream thing. But, you know, it was purely a fantasy. And at the time, there was no, you know, there was barely anything about MI6, the organization that allegedly James Bond worked for. There was nothing, a bit in fiction, and that was about it. These days, there's, you know, all loud and proud websites, open application, all of that kind of stuff, but not back then. And I parked it. I went on and finished school and did a bit of traveling, and then ultimately went to university. And I kind of, you know, had really sort of jettisoned any thoughts about it. But it was relatively early on in university that the thought returned. And within the mix of that was a sense of, okay, well, if, you know, if one wants to get into MI6, how does one do it? And, you know, there was enough out there to know that probably MI6 recruited via talent spotters, the lion's share of whom would be in universities spread across the United Kingdom. And so I thought, well, I'm in the right place. If it's going to happen, I'm in the right place. But that's, you know, that's just a thought. How do I progress it? Then sort of chance, circumstance, and possibly a bit of manipulation came into play, because I started doing some work with a particular professor at university on some political papers. And in the margins of that, he and I would have conversations. And this was sort of early on in my second year, I guess, something like that. And at one point he asked me, what do you want to do when you graduate from university? And I replied very deliberately in terms of phraseology that I was interested in a government position within foreign service. And I used the phrase foreign service, as I say, deliberately, rather than the diplomatic corps, which back then was known as the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. But I said foreign service. And obviously that resonated with him. And but that was that. And then we carried on doing what we were doing academically. And but over the course of, I would say, about a year, we'd return to the subject. And it became clear to me that he was a talent spotter, but never said it as such. And, you know, we were playing this sort of merry game, a little dance, really, where it got to a stage where he knew that I knew that he knew that I knew, et cetera, et cetera. What we were talking about, but it was never made explicit. It was never articulated. But it culminated, and I'm bullet pointing here, obviously, but it culminated in him saying to me, look, there are some people in London that I'd like you to meet. And I said, yes, of course. And so I went down to London and met these people in a very salubrious central London location, building, very old, prestigious location. And it was pretty much within the opening minutes of that encounter that one of them said to me, look, do you know who you're talking to? And my reply to that was, yes, I do. You are the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. Their reply, yes, we are. So now we can have an open, frank discussion, which was exactly what then followed. So that was my entree to MI6, and via that process, which statistically was bonkers, the chances of it ever, you know, happening, goodness knows, but that's the kind of person I am. I do tend to go for things, even if they are, you know, the odds are, you know, crazy.
I love that, and I've got hundreds of questions kind of bouncing around my brain. I'm gonna pick two. I'm gonna throw two questions at you and see kind of where we end up, Matthew. But I guess break down that conversation as much as you're allowed to talk about what that actually looked like, that initial conversation. And also, if we were to bring that professor into this podcast now and ask, what was it they saw in you back then that would make you a good fit for MI6? What were those attributes and what were those skills?
Well, on the first point about the initial conversation with MI6, obviously I can't really go into too many specifics, but it goes without saying they were really just sort of sounding me out, feeling me out, trying to get the measure of me as an individual. And it was a relatively benign encounter. And I think from memory, there were three of them there. I'm taking in turns to ask questions, really just trying to get an assessment, I guess, of my character and motivation, what I wanted to do, all the rest of it, but a little bit about my background, aspirations, how I was doing at university. But, if anything, it was a fairly sort of bog standard first round type interview. Nothing remarkable, but very deliberately that way, I suspect. Because, give somebody enough rope, they'll hang themselves. They probably just wanted to see, what came out of my mouth. What happened thereafter, and we can get into the whole selection process if you like, but what happened thereafter was then I was put through the whole process, cognitive tests, further interviews, assessment centers, back to more interviews, back to more tests, et cetera, et cetera. But that early encounter was really just more of a chat in that respect. And it was very civilized. It wasn't awkward. So that was that. In terms of what the university professor was looking for in me, very difficult to answer. And I had no contact with him since. It was sort of very sort of gentlemanly, right, off you go and good luck and all that kind of stuff. And that was it. So I've never posed the question to him since. Indeed, if he's still around, I don't know. But, it's an interesting one. But I can add to that question that many years later, when I was a very experienced officer, I remember having a chat with another very senior operational officer who was doing a stint in recruitment, in the recruitment department of MI6. He'd been overseas and he'd come back, and as is the way of things sometimes, MI6 will give operational officers a London job, largely just sort of a decompression type thing. And in this operational officer's case, as I say, head of recruitment, recruiting new entrants, new spies to the service, people who are going to be deployed at the front line. And I remember asking him, I said, look, now you're doing this job, what, over and above all the tick box stuff, intellect and interpersonal skills, and problem solving, all the other sort of stuff that you look for in candidates, over and above all of that, what is it that you makes a potential MI6 candidate stand out from, say, somebody who's applying to the fast stream of the diplomatic service or home office or whatever it is? And he said, well, to be honest, it's really difficult to put in, to quantify, to put in objective terms. And really, he said, we're looking for a particular breed of animal, a very rare breed of animal. And sometimes, providing somebody has met all the other criteria, sometimes it's just simply a case of somebody walks into a room and you look at them and think, yeah, that person is different. And I guess in modern parlance, we sort of use the phrase that X factor or something like that, but not a phrase we use. But simply that, somebody who is different, there's something about them that stands out. But the reason why it's so difficult to say, okay, well, come on, let's drill down, let's try and work out what that difference is, it's very difficult, because what I can say with conviction is that whilst there are commonalities in play, MI6 officers, character-wise, shape and size, background, all the rest of it, are can be very, very different people. So it's not a one-size fits-all type situation within that. it is a case of every individual scrutinized with a view to could they do the job. And, you know, there could be, you know, lots of different, as I say, lots of different backgrounds in play to meet that criteria.
And then how would you define your expectations versus reality when you did join? What were the common misconceptions versus the truth of those early days?
Yeah, it was really unusual for me because just to position it, I joined in the mid-1990s, so after the collapse of the Soviet Union, end of the Cold War and all that. And again, no knowledge was out there, no print about what MI6 did or anything else like that. So my frames of reference were quite literally, you know, fictional accounts of MI6, the Cold War, the slow burn chess game, all of that kind of stuff. John le Carré's Tinker Tailor, you know, you name it. There was a nagging thought that I had, having gone through the whole selection process, which with security vetting in the mix took well over a year. I mean, it was the hardest job in the world to apply for, I think. But despite all of that, then thinking, well, actually, okay, you know, what is MI6 doing now? You know, am I going to go in there and it's just going to be a glorified desk job? You know, at best, chasing after, I don't know, international criminals or, you know, spying on, you know, some sort of trade deal or something like that, something deathly dull. So I did have that sort of thought. It put me off because, you know, it's MI6 and all the rest of it, but I did have that worry. Then what happened? Day one of joining, all new entrants, in my case, I think it was an intake of around about 30, go on a 6-month training course, very, very intensive course, as you would expect. And but day one of that course, what they do is start giving you, you know, sort of lectures, addresses, talks, really, from people, you know, senior operational officers, retired, even, you know, foreign defectors, former, you know, KGB officers, all that kind of stuff. And they do that. And the reason they do that is to give you a real sense of, you know, what it is you're joining and what the organization is about. And so real cases are described from, you know, historical cases, all the rest of it, plus discussion about contemporary activities. And right at the beginning of that course, it's fair to say my jaw dropped to the ground, as did the jaws of every other new entrant, because we all realize, my goodness me, not only is this business as usual, but actually things have got infinitely more complex, infinitely more dangerous, given the activities of MI6. And so there was this sense, I guess, of exhilaration that we're joining an organization that is right at the cutting edge of activity, and it's really got its work cut out in many respects way more than it had done during, as I say, the Cold War, the slow burn of that dynamic. So, you know, our brains were quickly focused as a result of that.
And is that a geopolitical picture that was presented to you that made you feel like that?
Geopolitical, yes, but very task orientated. It's worth me mentioning about, just taking a step back, MI6, I never had, not one day of working in MI6 where I had a sense of I was working for an organization that was in any way political or, you know, within the political sphere. We were objective driven, task driven. Everything was about the operation, as we call them, mission, as the Americans call them. So, you know, in terms of those descriptions about the landscape, the geopolitical landscape and the military landscape, economic landscape, you name it, it was all about the threats, all about the dangers, all about, you know, where we need to look, what we need to be doing, all of that, rather than sort of overarching commentary about, I don't know, democracy versus autocracy, or that kind of stuff.
Okay, okay. And we've had a couple of people that have been in the CIA and gone on to be involved in businesses and things like that post-CIA. And one thing that we're always interested in is the decision-making ability of operatives. So obviously for me and Jack, who have no background, our decisions are clouded by our own emotions, probably life experience, and we probably make decisions that are biased based on that. So what is your relationship, or what can you tell us about how you've crafted that skill to be able to make decisions as unbiasedly as possible?
I think actually, just turning that on its head, I think bias can be a very good thing. And in terms of listening to one's instincts, we had a phrase in MI6 called using one's antennae. And in MI6, there was no real sort of textbook, rule book, about reading people, for example, and decision making. People like me were recruited because of essentially who we are before we even step through the front door of MI6. Our judgment, our ability to strip down the soul of counterparts and various other things. We all had slightly different ways of doing things, but our insight, our perception was a precious commodity. Where that insight and perception came from, well, again, it may be something that is innate, that within our characters. And so if anything, MI6 encouraged us to use what you would perhaps describe as bias, our judgment, our personal frames of reference, all of that. It actually wanted to draw that out and deploy it against the threats that we face, rather than break it down, quash it, and then rebuild it in some new model, which, with the greatest respect, might be much more the American model, but it is not the way that we do it, and never have done it that way. So, I always like to think of, in terms of stuff I did, when crafting an operation, before even setting foot, on a plane or whatever, it would be down to me, the individual intelligence officer, case officer, to actually decide how to do the operation. But I always think, put 10 similar intelligence officers in a room and give them the same problem to solve, they come up with 10 different solutions, all of which probably would be good. So that individual judgment, that individual, intellect and ability to scrutinize things from the perception of the individual rather than from, for example, an MI6 textbook, not that they existed.
That's good. We, when we have guests on, Matthew, we usually feel like they sit on one side of the fence when it comes to persuasion. So I guess when it comes to persuasion and convincing, what are your thoughts? Do you believe that, is it possible to persuade somebody?
Yeah, well, that was what I used to do. I mean, just to position that point, a large part of what I would do would be trying to recruit foreign spies, people overseas who had access to the secrets that I wanted. When I say I was the facilitator, but what the Joint Intelligence Committee and government and cross-party committees and our allies wanted. This was all a top-down thing. We didn't just go out and do what we wanted. But to do that, a large part of it was what we call human-to-human intelligence, gleaned from well-placed individuals overseas. Now, when I pop along and get alongside them in whatever guise I'm in, alias and cover and all the rest of it, over time, essentially, there comes a point where I have to declare my hand and say to them, look, in sort of softer words than I'm about to use, but essentially, look, I want you to betray your country, and I want you to do something which, if you're caught, will at best put you in prison for life, at worst have you put against a wall and shot. And also, by the way, your family might also be shot, and the extended family. So, you know, asking people to do that does require some persuasion, I suggest. But it's the way that persuasion is done. There cannot, you know, a fine line between persuasion and coercion. Coercion, of course, does not work because people will bail. So it's really persuading people to that that way of thinking. And then within that dynamic, and this was a key thing of what I would do, certainly as a case officer, giving them leadership. So I would never ask somebody to do something that I wouldn't do myself. And very often I would do it myself. So giving them that leadership, allowing them to draw strength from me, getting them to realize they're not in this on their own, that I'm there for them. So persuasion, yes, but hopefully not in a pejorative kind of way. It's much more in terms of, this is what we need to do. Are you on board? Yes or no, type of approach.
I'm always looking to kind of get the tidbits out when it comes to communication. So I guess, like, when you're going through that process, so we've established that you're going to try and persuade somebody to do something quite big. I guess, what are the fundamental ingredients? What goes into that? Like, what are you logically thinking? What are the steps that you know you need to tick in order to persuade somebody? Are there any, like, communication hacks or skills that you use every single time?
No, bending with the wind is the way forward in that respect, because the fundamental ingredients, as you've described, vary person to person. And so starting point for me would be obviously knowing what secrets are required, but then thinking, okay, how are we going to do that? And, you know, which people can help me with that. Now, MI6 has what it calls targeting officers, desk officers, whose sole job is to look at potential human targets for people like me, the operational officers. And, you know, very often there can be people who have got tremendous access to secrets that we want, but are completely untouchable. They have no chinks in their armor. There's nothing, no way in for me whatsoever. So they're unrecruitable. But the targeting officers would always be looking for little snippets, you know, tidbits, anything gleaned from intelligence information gained overseas on individuals, anything that would help somebody like me find a route in. Now, that route in, and this was, you know, this was the training for people like me, was the ability to think laterally and creatively. But that route in really would vary according to the individual that I was looking at. So I would keep a very open mind. I would always think, okay, you know, sometimes it could be something fairly obvious, such as somebody is looking for cash. And you think, okay, well, that's fairly straightforward. Although MI6 does not really warm to, you know, sort of paycheck kind of espionage. It prefers, you know, people to be motivated for other reasons, because the problem with people taking money is they can become greedy, and therefore they can embellish stuff just to get more cash, etc., etc. The Americans love it, but we tend not to like it. But we will pay them money, you know, as sweetness and stuff like that. But it could be that. But I would always be looking for something else, or it may have no financial component whatsoever. It could be, I don't know, it could be requirement for healthcare for a family member, it could be educational, it could be obviously ideological dissatisfaction with the regime within the country where they're located. It could be any number of things. You know, it could be even just something fairly sort of selfish, passed over for a promotion or whatever it will be. I wouldn't mind. I would always just be looking for, as I described, that chink in the armor, something that would just give me a potential opening from which then I could really, you know, establish a relationship. Then within that, I would try to think, okay, how can I get alongside this person? And then that would be me thinking, what cover am I going to be, you know, background, all the rest of it that goes there. And a huge amount of effort goes into that. With a view to then somehow getting contact with the target individual, and then forming a relationship on whatever basis I deem fit, according to that initial chink in the armor, as I described, and building that relationship and getting it to a point where either A, I cross the threshold and say I'm MI6, or B, I continue this fictitious cover relationship, but I get them to a point where they're passing top secrets to me for whatever reason, and I maintain the cover throughout. But within, and again, I mean, there's so much detail within everything I've just briefly said, but again, within that, the key thing is always be responsive to the individual. It goes back to your point about early on about, you know, that we're all imbued with bias and our own individual judgments and frames of reference. But we use that. We accept that. That is the world that we live in. So don't think there's just a, you know, an easy to read checklist of, you know, human behavior. Let's adapt it and let's, you know, let's react to it accordingly, as long as we can then steer it in the direction that we want.
Amazing. And then it's probably a minor point, but are you learning the language of the country that you're operating in, or are you working through a translator? Does that vary?
Well, blimey, the concept of working through a translator, that would be interesting. Never that. I personally didn't. The way that MI6 works is it doesn't, for the operational officers, it doesn't actively recruit people with languages. It has a view that if somebody requires the language, they will be put onto a year's one-to-one language training every day. With a native speaker, so complete immersion to get to wow. Really up to sort of at least business level, but actually very often to native speaking level in that language. But, you know, it is very target specific. So, you know, I work with people who, you know, for years didn't use languages and then suddenly taken to one side and said, right, that's it, you've got to go learn, I don't know, whatever, Russian, Chinese, whatever it will be. And they do it. And that's that. But in my case, no, because there was never any requirement. Because of the nature, the senior levels that I was targeting, the types of people that I was talking to, fluent English was their second language. So communication was never an issue. But if needs be, I would have done language training if the requirement was there. People operating in other areas where it can be more pertinent. If you're dealing with, for example, terrorism, then, you know, you won't just be targeting senior people. You'll also be targeting people at a much lower level, the people that are actually going out doing the acts and all the rest of it. And therefore, you may need to speak their language in order to infiltrate, assimilate, or whatever. But again, it's target specific.
Wow, fascinating. And then obviously we could probably talk about your career for another few hours in MI6, but I'm conscious of moving on to other things. Just one thing that you'd have a unique perspective on. Obviously, at the minute when you turn on the news, there is global conflict that we see. In terms of the picture that you see in those conflict zones compared to what comes back to us on the news, are we seeing a doctored version of reality? How do you define that now, being back in civilian life? There's probably some unique insight on that.
Yeah, I mean, these days, I'm like everyone else. I get the news as well, and I read it look at it. I mean, it goes without saying. I mean, we look at things. I mean, let's just take Ukraine or Gaza or whatever else is, you know, currently going on, and huge amounts of intelligence activity going on behind the scenes. That is the secret world. It is secret, and that's the world that I inhabited. And so I know for certain the types of activities, for example, that MI6 will be taking right now, and what it will be doing, what, you know, people like me will be doing, and exceptionally dangerous, fraught, activities. I'll be careful with, you know, talking too much about the specifics, but a huge amount of activity will be taking place. But always remember, I think it's very important as well for people like me to articulate that, you know, spies were only part of the equation. You know, we're there to obtain the secrets, and the secrets are only valuable in terms of what they can do, you know, what they can support or influence or, you know, bolster, whatever it will be. And so we're part of the jigsaw, crucial part of the jigsaw that can sway global events, of course. But, you know, a lot of what we are seeing on the news, you know, will be the important stuff, you know, who's winning the wars, or, you know, who's been killed, or what's the, you know, what are the political leaders saying, or reactions and all that. These things still matter enormously. But of course, you know, things that are going on in the background, things that are influencing all of that, well, that remains secret.
Matthew, you're an incredible speaker. I could listen to you all day and listen to your stories. I guess, as somebody that probably has lived their whole life five steps ahead at a time, what is next for you? What does the future hold for Matthew Dunn?
Creativity is my passion, and in fact, creativity was a key theme throughout MI6 as well, and childhood as earlier referenced. So I'm still exceptionally active on in creative work. Writing is a passion. Storytelling, if anything, this is what I am these days, is a storyteller, and I love that because, I mean, you know, it puts smiles on people's faces. Stories, time immemorial, is what we've always done. It's our narrative, but it's a wonderful way to produce a narrative. And so that is my passion. So anything creative, anything that you know, gives me an outlet for that. So a lot of different projects on the go at the moment. As I mentioned earlier, theatre, TV, stuff going on. Various other things. I'm writing my 15th novel. I'm always constantly striving to, you know, do anything that's creative. Why? Who knows? It's just what drives me. It's my passion. And I think within that, I always have a sense of, always have had a sense ever since childhood, a sense of don't lead a dull life. You know, make it interesting. Why does today have to be boring? You know, just it doesn't have to be. You know, we limit ourselves sometimes. So I'm constantly chomping at the bit to do things and to enrich my life, and crucially, to enrich the lives of others, hopefully, as well.
Well, thank you for choosing to spend your time with us this morning. It's definitely been incredible. If people want to work with you, they want to get you in to come and talk, tell stories, they want to check out your books, where can they find you, Matthew?
Yeah, I'm all over the internet. Just put in Matthew Dunn Spy, you'll find me dead easy. But I'm on social media, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn is a good source for me. I also have a website, matthewdunnauthor.com, which lists all of my services, activities, contact details, etc. So very easy to reach out, and you know, providing it's a legitimate inquiry, I will always reply, because I'm always, as I say, always there to help and offer my services, you know, in whichever way, you know, people deem, you know, useful.